Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Katie Johnston.
And Katie, I have just discovered that I was wrong, but not completely mad, thinking that you were from Hawaii. So that was a good pre-taping bit of chat. To realize one can be wrong, but not insane, is quite helpful, I think. Right?
I did. I got to live there for about a year, which was a wonderful time in my life. But I am from New Mexico, very proudly from New Mexico. I sometimes joke that it's about 90% of my personality is being from that state.
Wow. Well, we might need to explore that a bit.
Yeah.
But to begin with, I'd like to ask you my usual question, which is to inquire whether you would share with us what's currently holding you back, preoccupying you, interesting you, dynamizing you.
Yes, thank you for asking. Well, last fall, I started a tenure track position after being a lecturer for some time. So on one level, I'm still very happily adjusting to my new role on campus. Also, my first book, Profiles and Plotlines, Data Surveillance in 21st Century Literature, was published last year by the University of Iowa Press as part of their New American Canon series. So I'm somewhere between still discussing that work with others and figuring out exactly what I want to write for my second book. Meanwhile, with the recent attention on artificial intelligence, both on and off campus, I've been invited to join a real range of conversations on AI, which has me discussing and thinking about my book in some new terms that I hadn't exactly anticipated, but that I'm finding very useful. And then across all of this, I suppose what's sustaining my interest, at least academically, is the persistent datafication of everyday life. Which the expanding markets for AI are only intensifying, and how contemporary literature and literary analysis can help confront this sort of mad dash towards quantifying everything.
Wow, so that's a lot. But I wonder if we could go back, 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 as they say in baseball commentary, but not that far back because it's new. And it's a wonderful book. For you to talk a bit about profiles and plot lines, much of which, by chance, fits in with some of these later socio-cultural, political-economic obsessions that you're engaging with. You weren't to know that when you started writing this wonderful book. But that's what's happened. So, if you could take us back to what Profiles and Plotlines does in its discussion of data surveillance, because yes, it's about literature, but so much more.
Thank you. I'm mobilizing, I think, contemporary literature and poetry to confront these unequal effects of surveillance-based profiling. I'm arguing that literature, it doesn't only track this growing apprehension about data surveillance, which I think it does, but it also provides some insight into the partial rhetorical nature of data profiling. So data's own narrative dimension, that it is also telling stories. Despite the claims of its neutrality and complete omniscience, right? That somehow it is completely objective, right? This is a story that we're often told about data, but that of course data analytics involves how we're going to label that data, what data we're going to data to collect in the first place, what doesn't get collected, but it's always partial in both senses of the word, right? It's incomplete. Right. And it's also coming from a particular ideological point of view in the way that it becomes mobilized. So as this trend just keeps increasing and increasing, I thought this is a form of storytelling. And so let's turn to literature and what can literature teach us about those forms of storytelling? So motivating the book is in part a conviction that we need to rethink politically, rhetorically, creatively, how we think and talk about data surveillance, that understanding it's never neutral, right? That it is this form of storytelling and characterization, even in our society, we are the characters, but it's this form of characterization. And then by turning towards literature, I'm able to consider how data profiling might be untethered from those claims of objectivity, clearing the way to address how it functions rhetorically and materially. So, I guess, for example, through the lenses of literature, the book examines how data profiles, for example, reify identities of suspicion. They exacerbate inequality. They create categories of riskiness. So it's not just that a person is at risk of this or at risk of, but they themselves become figures of riskiness. And how does that happen? So I'm arguing that we shift the conversation a bit from the focus on privacy to systematic discrimination and how that gets scaled by these computational technologies. And ultimately, I'm arguing that contemporary literature sort of ironically gives big data this much needed reality check by bringing it down from the clouds and embedding it in complex social relations. I think this is one of the things that literature can do is that it doesn't isolate variables. It allows for very messy, thick context. Right. And so I think that it's well suited to do that work and sort of cracking open the numbers to show just how embedded they are in social, political, economic realities.
And could you share with us some of the works of literature that you engage in the book?
Sure, yeah. And I choose these not because they confront literature most overtly or directly amid this field of literature that I think is very interested in this topic. There are other texts that perhaps tackle this more directly. Dave Edgar's The Circle is a clear example of a book that really is about data surveillance on its surface. But I chose Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. She has a follow-up to that novel that I'm reading and trying to write about right now called The Candy House that does address it more overtly. But in Goon Squad, it was a little bit more buried in there. You know, I had to all the work I had to do to find it in Goon Squad is really on the surface in Candy House. But that book, which I think helps to set up the relationship between celebrity culture and data surveillance, this idea that inquiring minds want to know and that's somehow flattering to be the subject of so much interest and not scrutiny, but like that people want to know about you. And isn't that nice, right? And so it helps set up that relationship. It also looks at the gendered dynamics of watching and being watched, right? That this is never a neutral affair. Like who does the watching and who's being watched sort of matters in these gendered and racialized terms. The next book is William Gibson's Pattern Recognition. And that one, you actually recommended that one to me, Toby. You were the one who first sort of recommended that book outside of this context completely, but it's a brilliant novel. And in this one, he's really thinking about labor, I think, and it allows a sort of Marxist interpretation of what's happening. We're going to go behind sort of into the hidden abode of labor and find out really what's going on there. And what you find is that this sort of that the labor's working on both sides at this point, that the consumers are doing a lot of unpaid labor, and that the so-called producers, right, are also sort of influencing our patterns of consumption, right? That it becomes a little bit messy in those terms. The third book is Claudia Rankine's Citizen, which is the only book of poetry that I look at. And there I turn to Simone Brown's work on racializing surveillance. Brilliant, brilliant book that helps to think about how it's not just that people of color are over-surveilled, they are, but that surveillance helps produce and reify racial categories in the first place. There is no race outside of surveillance, right? And in that book of poetry, which is really about microaggressions in a certain way, the sort of racialized microaggressions, but it has this interesting piece in it about Serena Williams being surveilled on the tennis court and turning to this Hawkeye technology. She's on the tennis court and she Rankine recounts this so beautifully, powerfully, but she's on the tennis court always being hyper surveilled by the umpires and by the commentators in certain ways where and it starts with this match where Marianna Alves calls balls out of line, right? They keep, and it's there, no one agrees. And the commentators are like, what? That's in line. That can't be the case. And it was the impetus to bring in this Hawkeye technology to the tennis matches where, well, okay, we'll use some sort of technological solution here to this problem and we can find out. And as soon as that happens, what we find is that Serena herself is called out of line. Okay, it's a foot fault. Right. So it's now this line of sight that we're redirecting our attention from the balls to Serena herself, who was always the problem, right? It was always her blackness, her physicality, her very presence on the tennis court that was the problem, right? And Rankin does such a great job of drawing that out. And I'm hoping what I hope I'm contributing is sort of reframing this in terms of racializing surveillance and seeing how this respectability politics, this idea that, there's a respectable, proper way to respond to racism, intersects with the ways that we're taught to think about surveillance, that if you haven't done anything wrong, then you have nothing to hide, and that you can't object to surveillance without affirming your own guilt, right? Well, what are you worried about? Right? Is the retort. Like, what do you have something to hide? What are you worried about? And that both are means of suppressing any kind of opposition, and not coincidentally so, that surveillance is always wrapped up with race. The fourth book is Moshe Hamid's How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. And this is a self-help satire. It's not a self-help book at all. It's written in the second person, and it's about, here's the steps to becoming filthy rich, right, in this sort of context. But of course, some of the advice is things like be born a male, right? Things that one can't just sort of bootstrap their way towards. And in this book, there's this fascinating chapter where the author really hijacks the technologies of surveillance in order to narrate the story, so that the we're inside the point of view of this surveillance technology. And so we're moving from inside a person's personal computer or out into the telecommunications companies. So we're piecing together this narrative through the points of view of this different tech. And we're able to see its fallibility, like where it's getting things wrong, and we know it. We're able to see like what kind of narrative it's constructing about these characters and how that may or may not align with what we know about the characters from a different point of view and a different narrative structure. So that book is especially interested for really thinking about the narrative dimension of this and how it can be used to piece together certain stories, to tell the story you want to tell. And not just that, but write the future that you want to write. And it's also sort of brings in the questions of sort of the most, takes it to this sort of darkest place of drone warfare and thinking about like when the stakes really do get high, when these tales can really become matters of life and death, how it's not just a matter of understanding how to make a person legible and intelligible, but also sometimes marking them as expendable. And so it takes it to this really particularly like catastrophic place and raises the stakes in order for us to see that. So those are the four novels. There's so many others. I mean, as I'm moving forward with this, I think, oh, that book would have been another one, right? And especially as I'm turning this into syllabi to work with students, it's been fun to think about what other books I could be drawing in
And
to
Prof
this.
K, you're including some poetry there. And it seems to me that that's all too often excluded from the more radical edge of much of literary and cultural studies. For whatever reason, the novel remains preeminent as the object of study, but the poem has rather drifted away, it seems to me, at an impressionistic level anyway. So I think it's wonderful to be a little broader in your concerns.
And I'll admit, I chose a very prose poem, right? It's poetry is difficult. I think that we're not always trained and equipped to write about it, to even teach it in our classes. There's an intro to the major course, 204, where we have to include poetry, short stories, plays, and novels. And you hear people like, ooh, the poetry, right? I have to go back and remember how to talk and think and teach that. It was really a wonderful experience to work through the lyric poetry and to think about it in poetic terms, right? It's too easy to take that and just treat it like prose and dismiss the poetry of it all. And it was a good opportunity for me to try to actually think through what is the poetry, what are the specific affordances of poetry in this conversation?
And of course, part
And
of
they're
the
so real. That book, I think what I appreciate so much in terms of the topic I'm discussing is how it repaces and respaces our encounters with surveillance. Surveillance, David Lyons, surveillance scholar, says that power moves at the speed of the electronic signal, right? It's meant to just have this overwhelming operational tempo. It comes at us so fast, right? All of this data collection is so rapid, it's so quick that we sometimes can't even apprehend it, right? It just happens in the background. It becomes part of our very setting. And that book sort of respaces the encounters with this technology and pauses and freezes the frame and slows us down in a way that poetry really allows. It says, wait, let's really kind of, even in the way that poetry can create line breaks and like respace things physically on the page, it allows us to apprehend this a little bit differently.
And I guess one of the difficulties for critics is that often, whilst not necessarily seeking to be mimetic of the authors they discuss, it's tempting to write about things that are in continuous formal prose, because that's what you're having to write in most of the time yourself.
That's right. That's
So
right.
how do you, in some sense, echo what's being said in poetry, especially if, should you quote some of it, you might have to pay thousands of dollars?
Well, there's that. There's that. Yeah.
Is another big issue. So, Prof, you've mentioned students, and I wondered if we could focus on them for a moment. I'd love to know what the attitude of your students is when you talk to them about surveillance. Are they worried about Big Brother in the sense of either the state or corporate capital? Are they worried about Amazon and Netflix and the FBI? Or is this something that they say, well, I want Amazon to tell me what I might like, and I don't break the law, so what's it matter if the state knows?
I have a self-selecting group of students, of course, and this semester I'm teaching a class called Writing Under Surveillance. So these are students who signed up, presumably with an interest in this course. This is a graduate seminar, and those students are, I'm not sure what their attitude coming in was, but at this point, they all seem terribly disturbed. But we haven't gotten to the state surveillance. That's in there. We're going to be reading the FBI files of notable writers, and just as their own pieces of tech, like as their own pieces of literature in a way. We're going to look at what those files say, what kind of literary criticism and analysis are they doing, what was coming out of the FBI in that way. So there's going to be this state surveillance bit of it, but I start with foundational theory on data surveillance and corporate surveillance, right? Because this is where my work focuses for the most part. And they are, there's this trade-off. There's this question of, well, it's convenient, right? I think Amazon has done an incredible job of reframing surveillance as service. Like, this is a form of customer service we're providing you, right? And there's a convenience to it, and becomes hard to imagine the alternative, I think, if you've grown up with this. Well, what would, this is the bargain we've made. Right, we have all these free services, so this is the bargain. And there is a little bit of, well, I haven't done anything wrong, so what should it matter, right? And I think that as though we get into the literature and the specific case studies and highlighting how there's a degree of privilege in taking that position from the start, right? That there's it is mostly marginalized communities that are most harmed, right? So they become very aware of that and concerned. I think the place that I have found them most energized is around educational surveillance. So we just did a week on ed tech, right? And many of these students are teachers themselves. This is an online class, so it was a little bit ironic that we're having to do all of this asynchronously and online through ed tech platforms. And they all caught that immediately and became a little troubled. But many of them are returning teachers seeking further accreditation. And they're also in a position of having to use a lot of ed tech in the K through 12 system. The ones who are university students or PhD students, or students who are imagining themselves as professors someday, are also thinking critically about the kind of Brightspace, Blackboard, Canvas, all of these learning management systems, and how do they influence the sort of the content that we teach? How do they shape the pedagogy? And who's collecting this data? And why exactly are the universities signing these massive contracts? What is the sort of economic incentive there, right? And that is the area that I have seen them most concerned, right? That they're really thinking about their own educations, their own roles as teachers in the classroom, probably because it's so clear there that this is not always to the benefit of their students. It's not how they were taught to teach. It's not what I have an 11-year-old, and her teacher in the class, they insist that all of their spelling word practice be done on an app. Well, okay. I mean, I've tried to tell my daughter, if you wrote the words down with a pencil and a paper, you'd probably remember them better. She says, yeah, but I have to use this app, and I'm going to have to use it. That's how my teacher
Right.
can see.
Well, and if these people looked at the Cornell laptop studies that have been going for 20 years, they'd know that this is all nonsense.
Right. And the
That
teachers
as
know.
you are saying, a piece of paper and a pencil and writing things down with it and on it increases your learning and helps the learning of those around you. Because if people are using varied technologies in the classroom that has an effect on those around them, not only they themselves. And people who focus on having lots of apps open or windows and have phones and iPads and laptops and so on turn out to be the worst at multi-skilling. I mean,
Yes.
so much evidence that this is all nonsense.
So much evidence. And the teachers know that, right? When I talked to my daughter's teacher, she said, I know. We've contracted though with these companies, and now we're compelled to use it, right? And the district feels very state of the art. They feel very high tech. And I suppose that there's a segment of the parents who appreciate sending their child to a very state of the art, high tech school, regardless of what the pedagogical research says. So my students are aware as teachers of how they're forced into these relationships with their students through technology. And then they're becoming sensitized to what is the data that's being collected about their students then, right? And about them as well. And it becomes a real labor question. It becomes a question of at the university level, right, as we see, we are now, and this is all a very post-COVID situation too. I say post-COVID, understanding the pandemic is still that it's still alive and well. But I think that in this moment of, we all have gotten very used to Zoom. We're all sort of used to this class is run asynchronously and online, right? In this moment where we're relying on so much technology to communicate and to teach our courses, the students realize that there was a loss there to a certain extent. And so they're curious to understand, why are we continuing this? How should it be continued? What are the and are I think recognizing that this is becoming a real labor question for the professors, for professors and for K-12 teachers as well. So to answer your question, I think it's that issue more than anything that I've seen the most energy from them around. The Netflix, that I feel like is unfortunately becomes kind of old news. They know that that's happening, and they don't really see an alternative that's very clear, right? It's becoming, there's a kind of surveillance realism that is set in, I think, to borrow Mark Fisher's words. And I around AI though, that sort of reawakens some of these conversations a little
Well,
bit.
you know, there's a rumor that Kate Middleton is applying for a job with you, and that this is why the fake photo of her with her bizarre octopus-like hands all over three children was created to hide the fact that she's actually on campus at Stony Brook, undergoing both advanced medical treatment but also a campus visit where she's being wined and dined to see whether she can smoke, drink a cocktail, and speak sensibly at the same time. If
Yeah,
you,
I'm not at liberty to talk about any of that on
I had
private.
a feeling you wouldn't be. I thought you would just deny this. Yeah, and we both know that you're living in denial, but that's your job, and I respect it.
That's right. That's right.
But yes, there is this incredible moral panic, and I've been showing my students those great photos of members of the Politburo and others in Stalin's circle who just disappear from photographs because they were sent to labor camps or shot or drowned or whatever. And I show them the drawing of the USS Maine being blown up by the Spaniards to justify the war over Cuba. And I say, I'm sorry, it has ever been thus.
I think the students seem, I mean, what I think surveillance, I went to the, jumping around here a bit, I went to the International Surveillance Museum in Washington, D.C. with my family. And it's called the Spy Museum. They don't use the word surveillance, they use the word spy, International Spy Museum. And it's very sensational. It's very fun. They're making as many connections to Hollywood as they possibly can. Throughout the whole thing. And they present themselves as giving this comprehensive view of the history of spying in the United States and really the world. And it's fascinating what's missing there, right? There's not any COINTELPRO. There's big gaps in the exhibition, but there's also this interesting distinction between spying and surveillance, right? Where spying is sexy and spying is sort of sensational and very James Bond and interesting, and surveillance is mundane, right? And surveillance is, you know, just sort of this quantification. There's not a story there. This is very boring, right? And trying to make that connection a little bit and think, what is the, well, asking students, what is that relationship, right? Is why do we not see data surveillance represented in these spaces in the same way? And how does that sort of mundaneness of it all allow it to sort of slide by? I think that they're both sliding by on in their with different strategies. Spying is very, again, sexy and interesting and well permissible because there's got to be a really good reason, and it's, you know, it's sort of intriguing. And surveillance is completely unintriguing in this context. Data surveillance is so unintriguing, right? And so both are allowed to kind of slide by, one by going high and the other by going low, and get missed either way. And I think that trying to make the data surveillance, like trying to represent that, is a challenge, right? Spying we can represent so easily. Right. How do we represent data surveillance, data collection? This is where I appreciate Rob Nixon on slow violence. It's the same problem. This is kind of how do you represent something that's so it's just in numbers, and it becomes this representational problem, I feel, and that's where literature can be helpful. But
Yes, along with the hockey stick graph, which is
yes.
quite handy, I think, in its own. But that's a graphic representation. So, Prof, I've got a couple more questions to ask, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you may wish to what we're
Okay.
discussing. I'm going to turn my picture off for a moment from you because I need to go and deal with the podcat for a second, who is causing a few problems. So.
Was hoping I get to meet the podcat, but with your picture off, I'm not going to get you.
Oh, well, you know, some let me yes, I have to see what kind of state he's in.
He's camera ready.
Is he camera ready? Because he didn't have time to put his concealer on, so he's
Film
a little bit
can do that
shy,
for
a
you.
little bit shy about meeting you, but let's see if he putting my head around the corner. So he was whining, but I can't see him for the moment. So let me just turn this off while I sort of contort my body in search of him, even as I ask you to tell us a bit about the New Mexico part of you that you were saying is so important. I think you said 95% New Mexico. And what that means, because that's, I think, really interesting, because up to now, your comments could come from any US Research One University scholar. And I say that, you know, admiringly, not critically. But what part of what you've been saying is New Mexican?
To connect it to the research is a fun idea. So I grew up in the desert southwest, about 30, 40 minutes from El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico. And I grew up there, going through border patrols, going through surveillance checkpoints, and never thinking twice about them. I mean, as a white girl and a woman, I just didn't even recognize at the time the privilege of that. They became sort of invisible. These data, these not data, these surveillance checkpoints became a little bit invisible to me. And then it was in college that I started to become. I had a roommate who would going home got stopped. The trunk was emptied. I was like, "What is going on here? This is every single time, right?" And I began to develop some awareness of the surveillance on the border and what that means for people today. It is Amazon Web Services. I mean, really, Amazon, because they host Palantir, they have a huge hand in border surveillance, which is
Right.
so digitized now.
Right.
And so, I mean, but it wouldn't be completely accurate to say that I was aware of this growing up or that it influenced my
Yep.
research. And I've sort of come to all of this in retrospect to understand a little bit about that. My appreciation for the state of New Mexico, right? I could go on and on. It is a nicely diverse, kind, but there's a slowness, there's a pacing to life there that I really appreciate. I guess that is another point of connection. There's a ease and slowness. I'm living in New York now, and I feel the contrast very deeply. New Mexico also has sort of great, big, bright blue skies. Everywhere you look, you feel like you have space. Right? You can see forever. There's a sense of perspective there. I think all of my work is motivated by an interest in point of view, the limits of our point of view, right? Always wanting a little bit more perspective, if possible, and having new points of view. And there's something about just the expansiveness of being there that allows you to at least have the illusion that you have a little bit more perspective on your life and your surroundings. And even when I land now, get off the plane, and when we go back frequently, and when we go back, there's my blood pressure drops, and you can see the horizon as far as you can look in every direction. And there's something about that I feel very calming. And it's the like too closeness of the world that I sometimes feel like I'm managing and writing about, that too closeness of data collection and surveillance. Everything feels very tight in a certain way, and I don't have that feeling when I'm there. Of course, it is a very hyper-surveilled space, and the border is. So I don't mean to suggest otherwise, but there's something about the landscape itself that allows for a little bit of perspective, which I'm, I guess, hungry for. And
And for folks unfamiliar with the US, the point about this is that the place not very far from where you grew up, El Paso, has as a sort of sister city over the border in Mexico, Ciudad Juárez, that you mentioned, which has very high murder rates, sexual violence, and all kinds of awful things that are associated in part with the tendency of foreign multinationals to set up assembly and manufacturing plants close to the US border where goods can be created and then sold in the US market without paying tariffs, part of a deal done in the mid-60s to almost get rid of guest worker programs in the US, but guaranteeing that there would still be work for Mexican folks across the border. So there is this duality there of relative wealth, although with some poverty, and
Sure.
relative security, and
That's
then
right.
feet away, violence and poverty and exploitation, and yet the same sky to be looked at, as you say.
The same river, right? The same. I mean, all the landscape itself takes on such meaning there, I think, because you do have this river right there at the border of the Rio Grande. You have this the there is such a cultural exchange that goes back and forth. The last time we were home, we went to Palomas, Mexico. It was the first time that we walked across the border in a while. Growing up, we walked across the border relatively frequently, right? That was available. It felt like there are still plenty of border commuters going back and forth every day, certainly. But it has become, more dangerous in ways and certainly marked that way. And it was really when I was 20 years old or thereabouts that we start to get a lot of warnings about crossing the border, right? And it's become a more militarized space. It's become more difficult for a lot of people just to be right there in that sort of borderland going back and forth. But I think still such just a deep appreciation and understanding if that's exactly what makes the area wonderful also. And everybody seemed, there seems to be at least some consensus, at least in the communities that I traveled in, that it is being there on the borders, having that cultural exchange that made it so wonderful, right? That is also its gift in every sense. So,
And my
yeah.
last question before throwing to you to add anything you want, Prof. Katie, is to ask you how you do your research, how you find things out.
Yeah. Well, reading, obviously, it's a lot of reading, although that's becomes difficult, I find, during the semesters. It's difficult to keep up with all there is to read. I think that the conversations on AI right now are moving faster than any of us can keep up with the reading on. Right? So I feel like we're often a little bit out ahead of our skis on that. But I think that the luxury of graduate school, right, is all this time to read and have these conversations with brilliant people, professors, and other fellow graduate students. And you're so spoiled for ideas during that time. And I was able to develop a project there that was interesting to me and carry it forward and write that first book, coming from this place of having so just being just flooded with interesting ideas on a regular basis. And now I finished that book. And something else sets in, right? You're trying to figure out the second book where you don't have those conversations going in the same ways. And you turn to things like your excellent podcast and trying to keep up with the literature and the conversations with students, certainly. Conversations with colleagues. I don't feel like we create as many opportunities for those as we should. We have a wonderful humanities institute at Stony Brook, and I try to go to as many of those talks as I can because it's in these moments hearing about other people's research that you can make connections and jot down ideas and become, really excited about somebody, encountering somebody else's work in that way is how you can kind of begin to create the kernels of your own projects, I think. But I have found, I mean, I'm junior faculty right now, and I have found that that is the difficult transition, right? From having coursework and professors and these sort of built-in opportunities, right, to always be developing your next idea, to now also be teaching the ideas that you've already formulated while trying to come up with the next one, right? Students are certainly very, very helpful, but I think I've been aware of that shift now as I'm developing that second project. I don't have as many opportunities to talk about what's next, what I'm sort of on my mind, what I'm reading as I would like. And I think that we could do a better job, right, creating those conversations among faculty. Instead, we have to talk about things like, program agendas. I mean, our faculty meetings are not that, obviously, right? And it would be nice to have more of those conversations, I think, in general. But where do I get ideas? Reading. Also, media is also media. I think I watch the show Severance, and I keep turning it over my head and thinking about that. But media also gives you, I think, literature, media give me a lot of. For personally, a lot of the stimulate a lot of the ideas that I have and things that I want to research.
And I think you're absolutely right about the better aspects of US doctoral education, which impressed me deeply in my time teaching doctoral students for many years. In New York and then in California, extraordinary quality, extraordinary commitment, and the rigor of this large number of classes that must be taken, and wide array of knowledge that must be ingested, but also the space to do so, infinitely superior to the hermetic world of the doctorate that is just writing the dissertation on 3 inches of Chaucer without knowing about the rest of the field. At the same time, the absence of ordinary seminars as part of the weekly life of the department is really The absence of that is really a tragedy. It's a loss. And it all too often means that you talk about boring things in amongst the faculty and things that cause despair and bitterness and
Yes.
some happiness rather than the things that brought you there in the first place. So,
You're
Prof,
talking about the business of the university. You're talking about the business of the department. You're
yeah.
surrounded by these brilliant people doing fascinating work, and instead you're talking about logistics a lot.
Right. And some of that is because academics have some level of capacity to govern their own circumstances in the US still. But increasingly, that's not really about faculty governance and democracy. It's actually about surveillance, accountability, so-called requirements. So, Prof, to finish, we've gone back to where we began. I wonder if there are things that we haven't discussed that you'd like to mention, or things we did touch on that you'd like to add to.
No, I can leave it there too. But I guess the one thing I want to add is just my gratitude for this invitation, this opportunity to talk with you. Your work has had a huge influence in the way that I think. I think that I do textual analysis, but I understand that now because of you as part as inseparable from questions of the political economy and production, reception, circulation, taking it all of it together. And that's been very much your influence. And I appreciate that so much. And this opportunity to talk with you here has just been wonderful. And I'm grateful for that. So thank you.
Thank you, Katie.